Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
I got stuff for you.
Holy moly.
I need to get some snakes and release them around my house.
But they love eating people. They love eating kids.
These guys are the scientists of the supernatural, lecturers leaving lessons for inquiring laymen. They are applying the scientific method to a world that baffles science. They are the cryptids of the corn.
Every day that you open your mouth,
I know, right?
I'm more convinced that you're abducted by aliens.
No.
And it just stood up. I mean, it just like kept going and going. And she goes, what the?
These are idiots.
I was laughing reading this because I already knew how you would feel.
Idiot. What part of the story fits your balloon?
Well,
this isn't a UFO. Yeah.
But who else has big black wings and red eyes?
Batman.
Well, Mothman.
Oh, yeah, Mothman.
Well, everyone, I think we know exactly what it is. So say it all with me. It was the Sandhill Crane.
Would you try it?
No.
You wouldn't eat it?
No.
Why?
Because they're probably toxic.
There'd be a lot of poop in my pants. Seeing a 6-foot alligator go swinging through the air and slam into a tree.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to Cryptids of the Corned Podcast. I am the great and powerful Mystery.
And I am J Clone 8.
Bum, bum, bum.
I was like, something was coming. Nope, just 8.
Just 8.
Mm.
Before we get rocking and rolling, I just have some new reviews to read.
Ooh, we got some new reviews.
So remember, guys, it really helps the show if you leave 5-star reviews.
Yes.
And if you listen to any of the other shows that we do or we produce, leave them 5-star reviews as well because it really helps us out.
It helps us with the algorithms.
All right. This one is Russell Says Go, says Skyfish and Chuckles is the title. I recently started listening to your show because the Apple algorithm thinks that it's a good place to go right after an episode of Blurry Creatures or Ninjas and Butterflies. It was not wrong.
Ah, the algorithm works in our favor.
Which I love both those podcasts.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah. They're great podcasts.
Absolutely.
So it's nice to be put into the...
that category.
Yeah. They're, I mean, obviously they're great. And then we got an updated 5-star review from Noob Fresh. You guys have gotten it together and you're both getting on the same page. The show is awesome. Me and my family love listening to every new episode. Good growth, Justin NJ, 5 stars.
Why, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Sorry.
Much appreciated.
I don't know why Apple makes them so small.
And because they're communists, I think, people at Apple.
I mean, they're, yeah.
I don't know.
Not a great company.
I don't know.
No mega corporation's great.
Correct.
So what's scarier than a monster in a cave?
A monster chasing you in a cave.
Yeah. I mean, that is pretty scary. What's scarier than that?
Oh, okay.
Can you add anything to that scenario that would make it scarier?
A fire?
I'm laughing because all the people at home know because the title. And you have no idea.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, that would make it scarier. Fire always makes things scary.
You're
dramatic
right.
Dramatic effect.
You're right. What's
maybe
the
some
exact,
lightning, like lightning bolt
exact
crash?
Exact opposite of fire.
Oh, ice.
Underwater.
Oh, okay.
So, what's the only thing scarier than a monster in a cave? A monster in an underwater cave.
A spelunking monster.
Yeah. So, we're going to talk about the Lake Superior cave monster.
Oh, okay. Lake Superior has cave monsters?
Yeah. So, and we've had on Great Lake monsters.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we did Lake Michigan several times and Lake Erie, obviously, Bessie and several other, like the Lake Erie Chomper. And so Lake Superior, you know, they're all connected.
We even did Lake Leelanau monster.
Yeah, Lake Leelanau. which is not a great lake.
Not a great lake, but it's a great lake
it is
to
a,
go
a
fishing
great,
in.
Comma, lake. No, I like lately and all. But yeah, I mean, the Great Lakes are, for people do not understand how big and how monstrous they are, especially Superior, Huron, and Michigan. Not saying anything about Erie, but as far as those lakes have sunk ships that cross the open ocean.
Yeah.
And yeah, can swallow things, you know.
Well, what was that? The legend Edmunds, lives on the Edmunds in Fitzgerald. The Chippewa. Yeah.
I can never remember if it was Superior or Huron. It sank.
What the heck's his name? Gordon Lightfoot. Lightfoot singing music. The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Great tune. Great song. Gordon Lightfoot's very underrated.
I cannot tell you how many times we'd be sitting around a campfire. It'd be like 2 or 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we'd play.
Gordon Lightfoot?
Yeah. Well, the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Right. The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
We'd all be singing it.
If you haven't heard that tune, you need to. It'll make your life better.
It's great.
Just Gordon Lightfoot in general will make your life better. Him and Jim Croce, they don't get enough, you know, shine in modern day.
So yeah, Lake Superior Cave Monster. And we're going to talk a lot about Lake Superior and its very unique special properties.
Ooh.
And that may draw a monster within. So a lot of the actual monster bark comes from Adam Benedict's work, which if you guys don't know who Adam Benedict is, he does a lot of amazing books. Monsters in Print, Ghost in Print, and Oddities in Print are the three books I own. But he also does the Pine Bearing Institute, which has a bunch of cryptids profiles and all kinds of fun stuff.
He's accumulated a lot of knowledge in this field.
Yeah. So let's talk about the great monster of Lake Superior. Believed but not verified to be have been sighted as far back as the 17th century, so that's 1600s to 1701, by explorers sent to the Superior area by Samuel de Champlain.
Okay.
Which is not the first time we've talked about Samuel de Champlain.
Champlain or Champlain?
Yeah, Champlain.
Okay.
Lake Champlain.
Oh, fair.
So another monster connected to this guy. The governor of New France at the time. The creature is most often described as looking like an absolutely massive aquatic snake. Prior to the arrival of Europeans, though, the Ojibwe people, an Algonquin-speaking tribe, spoke of the lake creature both demanding respect and fear, tones often being hushed. So I'm going to try to pronounce the Algonquin word for this creature.
Okay.
The Mishapishu. The Mishapishu.
That seems all right.
That's how it's spelled. Like mishappens to you.
Yeah.
Mishapishu. Or the Great Lynx or the Great Water Dragon.
Ooh, okay.
Kind of what it roughly translates to. Is a mix of a dragon and a cat with long horns, palmed paws, large scales, and a lot of amphibian-like qualities.
Hmm, okay.
Slime and gills and a long, slender body. The creature is also known as the underwater panther, which has come up on the show many, many times. One of the most important and powerful beings in the indigenous people of the Great Lakes region. It was believed to be the master of the water of all water creatures, as well as having additional powers over snakes. Creature is able to create storms, whirlpools, shapeshift, and provide protection for those willing to give offerings of tobacco, and made small game sacrifices as well. So when we were talking about, I can't remember if it was a Patreon or main show episode, we did the Ogopogo.
Yes.
Remember they had to offer a lot of stuff, or if not, the Ogopogo would come up and destroy. So whether that's the same creature or a similar creature or a creature under this, you know, as the Algonquins go, this creature is the top of all of the water beings, good, bad, and different.
So this, yeah, it's top dog here.
Yeah. So yeah, Europeans influence after countless years of eyewitness reports, the monster eventually modernized and adapted to be the name of Pressy, due to the few sightings that took place in the Pier Isles River in Michigan's UP.
Pressy?
Mm-hmm.
That's like, the name they came up with?
Yeah, because it's the Nessie, you know, and all that.
Where's the PR come from, the beginning?
The Prescute, or however you say it, Isles River, River is kind of in the front of where this creature was seen a bunch.
Okay.
Or some of the sightings were, so it just got named after kind of that river.
All right, fair enough.
The name, apparently, it's super difficult for some people to give the lake monster the name that isn't similar to Nessie. Although the names changed, depictions of the creature also got an update and now depend on who you ask. The monster looks like everything from a giant eel, a fish, or if the forever classical living dinosaur swimming across the lake.
Hmm.
Lake Superior Monster is now more in line with modern lake monsters than in its original depictions over the last 400 years. that changes, whether it's different creatures or, like we've talked about with the Loch Ness Monster special, that the long neck really wasn't a part of the sightings until the movie came out.
And the hoax photo.
And the hoax photo.
Yeah.
And then it kind of, you know, spun off there where half of the modern sightings, which, by the way, as of recording this, not when this comes out, there was just a really good video of Nessie a couple weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she made her one of her yearly appearances.
What do you think of the video? Is it like an authentic? You think authentic video of Nessie?
Yeah, actually. So if I didn't know,
or is there a twist at the end?
No, there's no twist.
Okay,
it's a fascinating video. If everybody didn't know, there's tons and tons of live streaming cameras all over Loch Ness, and there's whole groups of people that pretty much like, I don't know, if fan clubs, devoted groups, however you say it,
just watching the cameras, the footage.
They get together, have a couple beers, and just watch the cameras, you know, and have 6 or 7 screens up to watch the cameras.
Yeah,
I mean, I would do that if I lived there.
Right. Yeah.
So they you know, when they catch it, they put out the timestamp for everybody. Hey, go look at timestamp on camera 8. You know, for here.
See what you think.
See what you think. I don't know what that was. A large bird hit the roof.
Yeah, they're breaking in. Birds aren't. No, never mind.
But no, it just it. Almost to me, it was moving extremely slow, just along the surface. It looked, if I didn't know where the video was, it looked like a manatee.
Hmm. Okay.
Just a large, smooth animal kind of bumping its nose above the water a couple times. Really slow, though.
Wouldn't that be nuts?
I don't think it was a manatee, obviously.
Right.
I'm just saying, if I didn't know where the video was, that's where I would go.
Wouldn't that be fun, though, this whole time?
It's a stellar sea cow.
Yeah. Just it loves the lock. That's its vacation spot. Which I don't know why you'd ever choose that for your vacation spot, but you never know. One thing though that comes to mind with this thing,
Lake Superior monster,
yes, the cave,
yeah.
Dragon, whatever,
we'll get to the
water
cave.
Panther, is that at Chief Cornstalk's quote unquote grave?
It's Chief Cornstalk Memorial Park in Point Pleasant, West Virginia.
Yeah, they have a yes, that wonderful place.
If anybody doesn't know, we've talked about it a lot on the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's bad, and it's nothing to do with Point Pleasant. I love Point Pleasant as a town.
Yeah.
I love the community. Whoever built the monument and the park and all that stuff, Chief Cornstalk's quote-unquote bones are in the corner by the bathrooms, and his memorial is like 4 foot tall.
Yeah, maybe.
And then Dunmore's memorial is like 80 foot tall in the middle of Chief Cornstalk Memorial Park in Dunmore.
Gigantic.
Dunmore killed a lot of Native Americans.
Right, yeah. So it's just a weird way to memorialize Chief Cornstalk. But beside his grave is that stone they have, what it, I guess, put on the display under like a little makeshift pagoda.
Yeah.
Is a...
in a cage.
In a caged up, yeah. It's a carving of a water panther, or supposedly.
And you really can only see it when the stone is wet.
Yeah. It's pretty faded. Or worn.
Worn, faded, I don't know. You know, whatever. Yeah. But it's carving of what they say is a water panther.
Yeah, what they say is.
I've seen the stone wet and I've seen it dry. I would highly, I don't know if you're allowed to dump water on it or whatever. I imagine you're not allowed.
Probably not. But if you sneeze and you're holding a cup of water in your hand.
The one time when we were out at the Mothman Festival and it was pouring rain that whole weekend.
Yeah.
So the stone was always wet and you could see it pretty good.
Mm.
I kind of get otter vibes from it.
Well, either way, I just know that's what they put on the plaque.
Yes.
Water panther.
That's what they put on the plaque.
So, I mean, at least that's in the folklore of, America.
Water panthers are a huge part of a lot, especially the Algonquin tribes.
And
a lot of the northern tribes.
This was an Algonquin-speaking
Ojibwe. Ojibwe is one of the tribes under the Algonquin umbrella.
Right, yeah. So some stuff's lining up here.
Yeah, yeah. So now I got to find out where I was.
Ojibwe. Yeah.
Contrary to popular belief, there is thought to be another monster that also dwells in dangerous waters of Lake Superior, a strange beast that the sole reason we're talking about today. So this may not be the water panther. So it depends on who you ask, whether the cave monster is a water panther or if it's a whole other monster.
Right.
But they're kind of in the same area.
Okay.
So just like a bunch of Godzillas swimming around down in Lake Superior.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And no wonder why the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk.
Yeah. On Thursday of August 26th of 1886, the Manitowoc Pilot published an article titled The Lake Superior Monster. The article itself wasn't very long, no more than a few hundred words in tightly packed column, void of all drawings for reference. Within its margins, the article described an encounter between an unlucky man and a monster. As far as we can tell, only being described once. The creature, which differs generally from all recognized depictions of the water panther, seemed to be something entirely unique. And its uniqueness was thought to touch on so soon was given some background information. Let's talk about Lake Superior. It is the largest of all the Great Lakes in North America.
Okay.
In terms of order, it goes Lake Superior, which is 31,000 square miles.
Gosh,
Lake
so
Huron,
big.
23,000 square miles. Lake Michigan, 22,000 square miles. Lake Erie, 9,900 square miles. In Lake Ontario, which is 7,300 square miles.
Ah, I always thought Erie's was the smallest. All right, cool.
Remember when we were talking about this the other day, Ontario could almost be a bay.
Yeah.
Of the one of the other Great Lakes.
Right, yeah.
Because it kind of is.
Well, I'm trying to think where that is. That
Superior.
It's the Great Upper Basin. Is that Superior then?
Yeah, the big one, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I go
or
fishing.
Or Huron, now I can't remember.
I know it's, but Superior is significantly bigger than Huron, which is the second biggest.
Yeah, no, Superior is absolutely massive.
Yeah. Like you could fit.
Huron's big too.
You could fit Lake Erie in Huron and be just as big as Superior.
Three times.
Three times over here?
Oh, you could fit Lake Erie surface area
into
Lake Superior.
I was going to say into Huron and they'd still combined wouldn't be as big as
yes,
Superior.
That is correct.
Yeah.
You'd have two Great Lakes together.
I know that's a really odd way to describe things, but there I just did it.
Mm-hmm. Lake Superior. You want to guess what the average depth in Lake Superior is?
200 feet.
489 feet.
For average?
Average.
Dang.
Maximum depth that has been discovered so far is 1,333. Very deep.
That's a big hole. Wow.
Ontario.
What a hole.
Ontario is 283 average and 802 maximum. Michigan, I'll just tell you the maximums. Michigan is 923. Huron is 750. And Erie does have one hole that gets down to 210 feet.
Dang. So that's why I guess that.
That's on the Canadian side.
In the beginning, because that's what we're used to. Lake Erie's our lake, I'd say.
Yeah.
And so, it's not that big, not that
average
deep.
Depth for Erie is 60 feet.
Yeah, that's just crazy to think about.
And most of our side of the lake
is 20 feet.
Doesn't really touch past 40.
Yeah.
If you get out near the border or you get up near New York, you know, the Ohio waters are pretty much ubiquitously like 20 to 40 feet deep in mud.
Man, but great walleye, though.
It's
great walleye.
A lot of walleye.
Walleye capital of the world.
The numbers alone are amazing. Did you also know, taking the title for the world's largest freshwater lake by surface area, the lake is approximately the size. So what state, how big do you think, which state is as Lake Superior?
I'm just going to go by the ones near it. So Wisconsin.
South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
So the lake. Superior is roughly the same size, surface area wise, as South Carolina.
That's wild. That is wild. And I don't know if anyone, if you have not been on the Great Lakes, it is pretty crazy because you can get at least an ear. I'm mostly on Erie. I've been on a couple of the other ones, but I haven't been on all of them. But I've been on Erie a lot.
I've been on all of them.
And once you get out into Erie, you can't see the shore in any way.
Oh, no,
whatsoever.
I haven't been to Ontario.
You haven't been? Okay. But you can't see the shore. It's like you're out in the middle of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And Erie's the small one.
Well, we were on Michigan, which is the third biggest, Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And we're like sitting in like 700 feet of water fishing.
Yeah.
And you're 10, 15, you know, miles offshore.
It's like you're in the ocean. It's Erie.
It is. I've been in the open ocean.
Me too.
And I felt more odd in Lake Michigan than I did in the ocean.
Yeah, because you're in a little aluminum John boat with a...
Well, yeah, Lake Michigan, we were in like 700 foot of water.
And yeah.
When we were fishing on the wrecks in the ocean,
uh-huh.
I was watching another thing. We never went more than like 100 feet
yeah.
of depth.
700.
Still, you know, you're never going to be able to touch the bottom or anything, but it's different numbers.
Very, it's building size depths.
Mm-hmm. So the size of South Carolina, it also holds another strange title. This Great Lake contains within it the largest copper deposit.
Yeah, no, that's wild. I remember we talked about this before.
So while you wouldn't guess copper, one of the few native metals which occur naturally in a usable metallic form, which I never knew about copper before doing this.
What's that?
that when it comes out usable.
Like ready to go?
Yeah. It's one of the few metals that you don't have to process or very limited processing.
And right, yeah.
You see copper, like the nodes and stuff, like it looks like copper.
Yeah.
Like it just, there's a big hunk of it.
All you gotta do is polish her up and she's good to go.
Like you can buy the Lake Superior bookends, which are highly expensive, but there's just copper chunks that are the blue green on the outside. And then they, you know, they have the slice open so you can see the copper.
That's pretty neat.
It was found within Lake Superior. Archaeological evidence suggests the Lake Superior region suggests that the metal has been mined by ancient people within the area as far back as 3000 BC. Mm. Some historians will even argue that copper mining around Lake Superior took nearly 2000 years before the European Bronze Age even occurred.
Wow.
So that gets into some of the ancient civilization stuff that Graham's always talking about.
Graham Hancock,
yeah. There's some evidence that there was tons of copper mining, and we don't know where any of that copper ended up.
But Graham, the seeds back then proved that
there
was no metallurgy.
So somebody was mining copper. It was not the Europeans. Because that was one thought, that the Vikings or somebody from Europe came through the Great Lakes and was mining and bringing it back. Yeah. So copper has a fingerprint, like a chemical signature.
Okay.
All metal does. If anybody watches The Curse of Oak Island, they talk about that they can tell you the rough years, you know, metal was made or mined by, you know, certain, like arsenic for steel or bronze and stuff like that. Because there's arsenic contents, and then it disappears because people figured out arsenic's bad.
Interesting.
So they stopped using arsenic in metallurgy.
Okay.
So you can be like, well, it's not, you know, it's 1690s or earlier right off the rip because there's no arsenic in it.
Right.
But yeah, so all metals like that have a fingerprint. So you can find out where they came from and roughly the time they were mined.
Okay, interesting.
So there's a ton of copper missing.
So you can find out where it came from?
Yeah.
Roughly?
Yeah. Hmm. There's a ton of copper missing from these mines.
Okay.
Because they, like, all X poundage of copper was mined out of this area.
But if they find some of it, they should be able to tell if it came from there, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I mean, it's missing. Okay. As it ended up in, it wasn't used in Israel, you know, to make swords, you know, 4,000 years ago. Or, you know, in South Africa.
Or was it?
Well, as far as we know right now.
Oh, okay.
A monster is eating it.
Waiting for you to, like, at the end of the episode. And they found it in India. I don't know.
Maybe.
No, don't even start.
So like I said, some historians even argue, you know, 2000 years before the European Bronze Age, making claims even crazier. The evidence does suggest that the mining was taking place. Nobody knows who was doing the mining or where the copper ended up, at least most of it.
Mm-hmm.
The Ojibwe people, who took up residence in the Great Lakes, migrated to the area, according to legend, over 500 years ago in the 1500s. And when they arrived, worked copper mines were discovered there already abandoned.
Mm.
So these sites were already, what they say.
Before the natives.
Yeah, the Ojibwe say that they were already there in ancient when we got here.
Yeah.
And we've been here, you know, roughly 500 years. It is believed that there are nearly 5,000 mining pits, some around 20 feet deep, and were created by unknown ancient miners who had nothing but primitive stone hammers and hatchets by what appears to be struck on the sides of the stone walls.
Mm.
Even though nobody knows what these ancient people were, where it went, we do know that the copper left behind took a great significance for the arriving Ojibwe people. As referenced earlier, the great water panther is often described as prominent horns and large scales. But we didn't mention that these horns and scales are said to be made out of
copper,
pure copper. The reason for this is the water panther was said to be the guardian of the copper itself and would do anything it could to protect the precious metal.
Oh. But did he come about after the mine was done? Because it sounds like he didn't do a very good job.
Who's to say it was mined by people?
I don't know. Well, what are you trying to say?
There is even a legend around Lake Superior that talks about the Ojibwe youth, which unfortunately found himself locked in a battle with a water panther close to shore. During the fight, the boy was able to break off a piece of the great panther's tail by striking it with a broken canoe paddle. Understandably, this caused the creature to flee back into the depths. But it also benefited the boy more ways than you could imagine. It said that the piece that broke off the tail was made entirely out of solid copper. And since the boy knew about the magical powers said to possess, he kept the tail for himself as good luck. Well, the magic must have been real, as the legend goes, because as long as the boy kept the tail in his person, he was granted it with nothing but good luck with both hunting, fishing, and other aspects of life.
Hmm. So you just need a little water panther tail.
Yeah, if you can break the chunk off of one.
Yeah, screw the rabbit's foot.
Yes.
Give me a water panther tail. Let's start. Some of you guys start selling those. little keychains.
Oh, you know what? Maybe there'll be an item in the shop. Yeah. P.S. Tons of new t-shirts were just added to the website a couple weeks ago. Ooh,
exciting. Cryptsofthecorn.com.
Yeah. So as you can see, Lake Superior has a deeply rich history, not only for legendary monsters, but the copper mystery itself. The history goes back for centuries, and for some, gives credence to the monster stories which originated around it. So when the Marowak pilot ran the story in August, it only seemed to sense that a few short paragraphs would feature both a strange monster and a highly revered metal itself. So necessary background, let's talk about the story. So you ready?
Yep.
You're about a cave monster?
Yeah, I'm ready with copper horns and tails and, yeah.
So the story begins with a group of copper mine prospectors leading around an island within Lake Superior. The article goes on to state that nor does it make it clear it chose Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, or Canada. Basically just a random island. We don't know exactly where it was.
Okay, just somewhere up there.
Yeah. Anyway, the miners landed on an unknown island and started searching for signs of copper. When they found none on the surface, they got their equipment together and began to look underwater rock formations to indicate the presence of copper. Believing that they may have found some of interest, the men decided to set up camp, remain on the island, so they could have a full, uninterrupted day of searching the lake itself. When the night, though, something arrived at the island that would cause the men to wonder if they should even be out there at all. So what do you think happens?
I would say they probably shouldn't be. I mean, that's what it sounds like. But I don't know. I don't think anything happens. They probably just hear or something scary.
Oh, yeah.
Hear or see something scary.
So when the men camped close to the water's edge, the damp wind of the lake made its business to try to extinguish their fire. Constantly on the verge of going out, the main source of heat and light needed to be fed constantly, or else darkness would yet again creep back onto the island. Seeing that the ever-hungry flames could use another log, one of the men rose up to toss one in. But when he stood up, he caught sight of something strange moving through the water. There, within the darkness of the lake, was an extremely bright green light. Mm. Moving slowly and spreading out nearly 30 feet in diameter from a central point.
Okay.
So as he's watching this light grows to be about 30 feet wide.
Weird. Okay.
Is it?
Kind of.
While the sight was both beautiful and memorizing to the man, it caused them to rise and move as close to the water as possible, almost being lured in.
Mm.
One of the members in the group remembered stories he had heard and was told by the tribe living around the lake, that ones of about powerful creatures within the water, the creature could easily snatch unsuspecting men right from shore and drag them down to the bottom of the depth to consume them, the stories of the terrible water panther. So one of the guys knew, you know, he talked to the locals. So they're all standing on the edge of this water looking in. As this, you know, giant green, bright light was growing in the water. And then one of the guys finally snapped to and was like, oh, I heard stories of something. This is bad.
Yeah.
With his fears now approaching his limit, the lone miner urged his fellow cohorts to step away from the edge of the water and inform them quickly of what he believed was living within it. So he's screaming at him like, you know, it's the water panther. It's the water panther. Get away. The men listened with great interest as this light slowly came closer and closer. With all the members of the group now aware of the dangers that dwelled below the surface, one of the men grabbed a rifle and fired a shot into the water directly at the center of the light. Without hesitation, the lake went dark and the unknown source was gone without a trace.
Mm.
But no movement, no splashing, just light turned off.
Yep.
The remaining group members at once grabbed their firearms for the rest of the night. They watched and kept just in case whatever had made the light decided to come back. Lucky for them, though, whatever it was decided to stay away and let the men enjoy the rest of the night in peace, because apparently it too was waiting for the dawn of the new day to make its appearance again.
Ooh, okay.
So what are you thinking so far? You're camped out beside a lake. You're getting ready to go copper prospecting. It's late. You stand up. You see a little green light that slowly grows to be 30 feet in diameter.
Yeah.
It's getting closer and closer to shore.
Did it grow because it was getting closer or grow because it was just changing?
It seemed like it grew and then moved closer.
Okay.
So it started off as like a center point, like the size of a volleyball.
Okay. Gosh. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what does that. That's the only thing that's, I don't know. Why, should I know?
Yes.
A green light that expands?
Yeah.
I mean, besides orbs or I'm trying to think. I mean, an underwater creature. I don't know. Go on, I guess.
Well, why don't we take an ad break and we'll come back with the rest of the story.
Yeah, let me eat and think on it.
All right. Jay, I maybe hooked up a cable to Bob the Giant Mushroom and maybe plugged it into my brain. And I was getting a very strong message.
What did he say?
He said Flavors of the Forest is coming out with a new flavor.
A new flavor?
Lion's Mane Mushroom. The ultimate thing to meld mushroom and the human brain together.
Wow.
It's coming. Bob the Giant Mushroom was telling me, everybody has to try this new flavor. Flavors of the Forest, Bigfoot Breath, Lion's Mane.
So this is something I can, another food addition enhancer I can add to my food?
Lion's Mane, the superfood. The reproductive organ of the Lion's Mane Mushroom. Mm-hmm. Coming to Flavors of the Forest. Where can they be on the lookout for these new additions?
You can find this new additional flavor at flavorsforest.com/corn.
Be on the lookout for Bob and his kin. Great as always. Mm. All right. So yeah, stand on the shore. Light grows. They shoot at it. Light just turns off like that.
Shoot a little bit.
Yeah, if Troy was there, it'd be dead.
Probably.
It'd have it on the line, and it'd be in the boat. Anyways, so when the sun rose the next day, the men woke up with a renewed sense of purpose. The events that took place during the night no longer at the forefront of their mind. The strange green light had been replaced with images of copper and possibly striking it rich. The group cleaned up camp, gathered their things, and made their way back to the small barge which had brought them there. Once on board, the men began to the process of getting one and their own ready to go in their underwater in search for what was down there, copper. So yeah, keep in mind, this is 1880s.
Okay.
So they're going to go to the bottom of a lake and look for copper.
It's a good idea.
So scuba.
You need...
Kind of.
Yeah, they need resources.
So now one of the men, fully dressed in a 200-pound waterproof canvas suit with a bulky copper and brass helmet, was the luckily chosen one, slowly made his way towards the side of the barge and prepared to venture in. Do you remember, you know what these look like, right?
Yeah, that's like the old Scooby-Doo submarine outfits.
Yes.
Or not submarines, but...
But the hole you can see out of it is just as big as your eyes.
Right.
And they have two little ones on the side.
Nice.
And if you want to talk, quote unquote, to anybody above you, you just scream and hope they hear it through the air tube.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, I mean, in primitive times... You gotta get
copper.
Do it some way.
You need copper.
Yes.
So two members of the group manned the air supply pump, and another one gave instructions through the diver's telephone system, which is a sealed connected tube that attached the air hose and allowed the diver and the surface to quote unquote somewhat communicate.
Yeah, it works.
It's just a tube they would yell through.
It's like a cup and a string.
Two guys, the whole time you were down there, had to pump air to you.
Yeah.
By hand.
Have you ever seen the guys that do that still now? With like garden hoses?
Yeah, for the catfish. There's a couple noodlers that do it, and I think they're going to die every time.
This is somewhere in, it's another country, like Southeast Asia.
Well, we still do it here.
Well, what these guys do is they have like a little air pump, like up on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
One guy will man that and just make sure it's running. And it pumps air just through it, and they have a garden hose that they pump it through. And then the guy will dive down, put the garden hose in his mouth, and run like walk along the bottom of the ocean and forage and stuff.
Yeah.
All the while, the guy's on top of the boat just watching this crude pump.
Because if it breaks, his buddy dies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. But yeah, it's literally a garden hose.
You have to have somebody that can repair something extremely quick.
Yeah.
So your two buddies on the pump on this boat, you better really trust that they're strong and they pay attention. You don't want anybody getting distracted.
No.
I don't know if you could do it for me.
No, I would not.
You would get distracted. Good. You'd be talking to somebody, and
I'd not be good for that job. As I see you float back to the surface, oh.
No, I wouldn't float back to the surface. I'm wearing a 200-pound canvas and brass dive suit.
Eventually, I mean, you'd blow it up.
I don't think you could. So the two men, you know, manned it. The other one was getting ready to talk to him. Yeah, you should look. Anybody at home should look up the videos of people talking to these dive tube things. Even though they're only like 50 feet away most of the time. It is like the telephone string tin cans.
This probably work better.
And he's either saying there's a monster ripping my leg off or I found copper.
Right, yeah.
Same thing.
One or the other.
So with everything in working order, the diver took a deep breath to calm his nerves, picked up a bucket and a crowbar, attached a knife to his belt, and then leapt forward into the Great Lake with his heavy suit and weighted boots pulling him downward immediately. The diver sank to a depth of around 30 feet before making contact with the targeted area. With both feet firmly planted on the bottom, the diver began his search for the copper. He's just down there, 30 feet of water, looking for copper nodes with a crowbar
and
a bucket.
And a knife.
And a little knife on his side.
You're going to do some damage.
Oh, yeah. After being under the surface for only a short while, the diver was able to confirm their assumptions, as he and his cohorts had made about copper being in the area was correct. There ahead of him was the telltale signs of the submerged copper vein, a path of the green flaked rocks that snaked along the bottoms, almost like a painted stream.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So he's literally walking on like a path of copper.
Right, yeah.
It's all
oxidized
through
a little bit.
So the outside is green, but yeah, he knows that that's copper, so he can start taking the crowbar and working out just chunks
of
it.
Like Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. The diver, knowing that the vein would certainly lead towards an extremely large deposit, followed the vein followed the vein towards an overhanging rock and into what appeared to be an underwater cavern. As he processed inside, the hose attached to his helmet and leading up towards the surface pressed tightly against the rock overhanging. Knowing he wasn't able to advance much further, lest he'd break the hose and die, the diver turned around to head back towards the open water. But just as he was about to reach the cave's entrance, everything went black.
Uh-oh.
Not that he was knocked out.
No.
He turned around, and everything's black like it's night outside.
Interesting.
Confused, obviously, by what was occurring in front of him, the diver very slowly approached the area that, you know, with his arms outstretched. He knew this was his escape. Expecting to be greeted by an extremely hard surface like the large rock from the overhang had fallen, thus blocking his path. The diver, instead, what do you think he was found?
Oh, I mean, he probably ran into some fleshy blob.
Instead, found himself pressed up against a living, fleshy wall.
Oh, there you go. It's close.
Yeah. The shock was ecstatic as the living thing, which up until this point had kept hidden in the blackness around it, began to glow green. So it went from being black to starting to glow green.
So it's the thing. You know, the thing.
The diver, now fully aware of what he was looking at, tried to back away as quickly as possible. But the slack in his hose, which had limited by now the pressing rock and the creature pressing against it. So the hose, his lifeline,
right,
is tangled up on the overhang of the rock and this creature's body somehow. But the creature is just sitting there as of now. It's not doing nothing. It's just kind of hanging out.
Just kind of flopped down.
He walked past it and it kind of shot out behind him.
Okay.
Like he came into its cave and it kind of went out.
It shot out and closed the door, basically.
Yeah. Whether it was running from him or, you know, blocking him in.
Yeah.
We don't know as of now. So he tried to back away, slacken the hose, creature pressing. Unable to do whatever, the diver began yelling into his helmet in hopes that the sound would carry through the telephone system and alert his team back on the barge. While he was yelling was a last resort, it did actually prove successful in a way, and it was immediately heard. Sadly, though, it was by the creature.
Oh, so it turned around.
Mm-hmm. As he was yelling at maximum volume, the diver watched with wide eyes through the hole in the helmet as the green glowing beast began to move towards him slowly. Fearing what would happen next, the diver turned and tried to move forward, but was unable to because the hose was stretched to its absolute limit. Beginning to panic, the diver turned yet again to view the creature. Only this time, as he spun around, he made direct eye contact with a massive eye staring right back at him.
Oh, boy.
The diver reacted out of instinct. He grabbed his knife from his belt.
Stabbed the eye.
Shoving it forward into the eye of the creature. Like an explosion, the dull green light grew to such an intensity, it drove away every ounce of darkness inside the cave.
Jeez.
At that moment, the terrified diver was able to see the creature in all of its fearsome glory. There before him, blocking his exit, was a gigantic beast with large eyes, more than a dozen tentacles flailing wildly through the water, smashing into the wall. The diver, with his knife still in hand, slashed at the mass of tentacles moving around him. Every time, the sharp blade made contact with the thick, writhing arms. The creature grew more and more upset, grabbing at everything and everything it could wrap around its arms. While the diver was able to force back every tentacle attempting to grab him, the hose extending to the top of his helmet to the surface wasn't so lucky. The creature wrapped one of its arms around the man's life support system and began to pull it violently back and forth. The diver, now lifted off the ground and at the mercy of the flailing beast, continued to slash wildly with his knives in hope of striking any vital part of the monster. But with every second that passed by, his actions proved to be more and more difficult and more life-threatening. The hose, now completely twisted in the arms of the creature, was no longer doing its job of supplying oxygen. So the diver was becoming very exhausted very quickly.
Yeah, depleting his oxygen supply.
Along with this, the connections were being detached at the top of the helmet, and slowly trickling water was filling the copper headpiece.
Oh, no.
So he's being swung around underwater.
Yeah.
He's being choked out, and as he's looking up, the dreaded drip of water.
Yeah. He's getting the Chinese water torture treatment.
Recognizing that these next few minutes were likely his last, you know, this basically meant life or death, the diver focused all of his attentions on the tentacle that was beginning to wrap itself around his body. With his arms still free, the diver grabbed every ounce of strength, and he left and he plunged the knife into the thickest part of the tentacle around him. As soon as the blade pierced the flesh of the beast, the diver pulled the knife sideways right through the thickest part of the arm and successfully managed to almost completely sever the arm from the creature.
All right.
So shoved it in and just ripped.
Right, yeah.
And pretty much came off. Dark, dark blood spilled out of the stump into the water in the surrounding area. The beast pulled back in both shock and pain. Every arm released whatever it was grabbing tightly, and the green light began to flash with varying intensities across its whole body.
Okay.
So there's big flashing of the light. The monster, which packed its remaining arms tightly together, then shot forward into the depths of the dark cave. The only indication that it had left at all was a faint glow of the light that was being quickly consumed by the darkness. So the guy could slowly see the light disappearing deeper and deeper into the cave. Now on the verge of losing consciousness, the diver made a feeble attempt to escape the cave, but lack of oxygen and overwhelming exhaustion stopped the diver as quickly as he started. Fully accepting his fate was sealed. The diver, understandably shocked, he felt himself being lightly moved, not only out of the cave, but also out of open water. After only a few minutes, the diver was hauled to the surface, back to the barge with the rest of the group.
So they pulled him up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they're watching this hose go absolutely nuts. And here, first you hear,
and then
keep in mind, they're in a lake, right? They're not diving off the, you know, the Great Barrier Reef.
And they're only 40 feet down.
30.
30 feet down.
Mm-hmm. So this is supposed to be an easy dive. And it's looking like he's being ripped apart by a great white shark.
Yeah.
And Lake Superior is really clear. They can probably see a little bit of the glow of the light.
I'd imagine.
And the blood.
So. Yeah, I'd imagine the green glow. They'd have to.
Some of the lakes, like Torch and stuff, you can see 60 and 80 feet down.
Wow.
So after the diver had regained his composure and checking for injuries, the man in the barge related to him how the boat had been thrust around violently back and forth, as well as being pulled across the lake surface completely out of control. On one than more occasion, the diving hose was nearly completely ripped off the boat, but thankfully remaining attached due to the heavy pump equipment bolted on the barge. It wasn't until the hose went limp only a few minutes prior to them, the men were able to finally pull up the diver to the surface. After they were finished telling their side of the story, the diver related his own harrowing tale to the shock group. That's when they all said they were done. He managed to vow to never go back to the water again. With all in agreement, the men raised the anchor, headed ashore. Upon arrival back to dry land, the men disbanded and left the area to never return.
You know, there had to be one guy just like, oh, come on, we can. If they were fishing, there would have been one guy, we can get one more. We can get one more.
You go in the helmet.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I'll hold the hose for you.
Right, yeah. No, no, I'd say in this situation, I'd be with him. I'd be out immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Done. No more.
So before I give you some options and some science, because there's a lot of interesting stuff with the story.
Yeah.
There's not much to it. Like I said, it's, yeah, like we said in the beginning, it's one newspaper article. Whether it's real or not, it's completely, you know, I have no idea. But there is a lot of science clues in this article.
Yeah.
So before I get into what I think it may be, and this is the shortest list I've ever had.
Okay.
I only got like three options, and one of them is it's fake.
No, don't worry. I'll provide more.
So yeah, I mean, what do you think it is?
Well, I bet one of these on the list, it sounds like squid or something, or octopus. Okay. Squid. I'd say squid.
A squid?
Yeah.
In Lake Superior.
That's what it sounds like.
Okay.
The squids flash colors.
Yes, they do.
They glow if they want to.
Some of the species, yes.
Yeah. And they got tentacles.
Yeah.
And they also can be very violent.
Yes. Humboldt squids are extremely scary.
Yeah.
They only get 6 feet long, and they eat people.
Right. So that's my first thought is squid after the story.
To be fair with this story, the creature was not violent until he stabbed it in the eye.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm just saying the violence is not quite like a Humboldt squid's violence where they'll come and eat you.
Oh, yeah.
He walked into its home, you know, possibly.
Well, maybe like...
And then stabbed it in the eye.
Maybe the mega-sized freshwater ones are the same way. They're not that aggressive until push comes to shove. Yeah, sure.
So you're going squid or octopi?
Yeah, I think so.
Giant cephalopoda?
Yeah, cephalopoda. Tode.
Well, my first... Do you have any others before I continue?
Well, no, other than the water panther.
Oh, an actual water panther.
Yeah.
So to me, yes and no. I kind of have a thought about what the water panther may be. Because our friend Carrie, when she was drying her linden worm, the tassel worm.
There you go.
The tassel worm. She drew it like a giant salamander with some feline-like features. So that made me think of greater sirens. So maybe this was a greatest siren. Because a lot of the water panther's stories talk about it being very, very amphibian-like with some cat features.
Right, yeah.
So greater sirens, everybody doesn't know. You know what an axolotl is? A greater siren is basically an axolotl mermaid where they only have the front legs. They have a very similar head shape, but they have an extremely long, powerful snake-like body.
Right. Not the sirens like that L'Oreal into the
water. No, but they are named the same.
Correct, yes. Just, for people at home.
So greater sirens are the biggest... In the North America, they have historic relatives that got absolutely massive. They're normally clean water predators. So Lake Superior, deep, clean. Now they're pretty much only, just in a couple swamps, which...
Greater sirens?
Yeah.
Okay.
How
big again do they get?
Greater sirens get up to 5 feet, but they have some extinct relatives that got, 12 to 15.
Wow, okay.
So big.
Yeah.
They are active predators. They are capable. They look really soft, but they are capable of holding their own in a lot of fights.
Right.
A lot of times they'll eat venomous snakes and stuff like that.
Hmm.
So they're not scared. So where do the tentacles come from? The giant gill arches on greater sirens' heads. They have external gills they can flick around.
Would any of those couldn't like grab though things?
No, but I'm not, he may have just got tank. I'm talking about a massive one.
Okay.
Let's say it is a greater siren.
Yeah.
He came into its hole, which they live in holes a lot of times, or under stuff. Came into its hole. And he gets right up in its face and stabs it in the eye. And then this thing just starts slamming its head around, freaking out.
Yeah.
He just is getting wrapped up in the giant gill arches. And, he's seeing out of a 6-inch hole in a cave in the dark.
Well, gill arches, if you cut one off, it would bleed a lot, right?
Yeah. It's part of their circulatory respiratory system.
Well, that would explain part of the story, too.
Blood would pour out of it.
Yeah.
And that's how we could, cut it. Because even a normal-sized octopus... You're not winning that fight.
No.
One killed, a little octopus killed a diver just a couple years ago from pulling the mask off and not, fighting him and not giving it back.
Right, yeah.
And the diver was fighting for his life and died.
That's so sad. But it happens.
Yeah, they're strong. They're incredibly strong.
Right.
I don't really think that it's a greater siren, a great siren, but I just like the possibility. It was one I'd never seen post on here, and I just kind of got the image of a water panther. Maybe it is a giant, salamander with these giant gill arches, and that could be some of the tentacles, some of the long necks, some of the bumps, because they're huge, they're long. They have all these traits of different types of sea monsters.
Right.
So just because you've seen a sea monster with tentacles, that was a piece of a giant siren.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Or you see the long bump, that was the back. Or you've seen the writhing body, that's the tail.
Water panther.
Water panther. And they do kind of look feline.
I can see it.
Not extremely feline, but...
No, but just if you looked at the hands and feet.
Yeah, the hands, feet, they kind of have a little cat face.
Yeah, okay. The face even, yeah.
Yeah. Like, their general shape of their head, it kind of looks like a cat.
I can see it.
So it just made me think that maybe there's something to that, that the water panthers of the Great Lake region, maybe they are giant sirens. We used to have them up here, normal sirens.
Yeah.
Great sirens and lesser sirens. And then there's reticulated sirens, are the three species left in North America. And we just discovered reticulated sirens in like 2014.
Oh, relatively new discovery.
And they've been around for conventional evolutionary theory. They've been around for like 14 million years.
Oh, wow. And just discovered them.
Not even they're really good at hiding.
Sounds like it.
Even where you know they are, they're extremely reclusive. They're extremely shy. They do not like being seen. As far as the bioluminescence thing with this story, they are kind of biofluorescent to each other, but not bioluminescent.
Yeah, well, we don't know. Maybe that's a trait the greater ones lost. Yeah.
Maybe the giant ones have it.
Right, yeah.
All right. So let's get down with the real science of the episode.
Okay.
You figured it out.
I did?
Yeah. A giant freshwater octopus. Cephalopod in general is what I had written.
Oh, okay.
To me, it fits more of an octopus than a squid.
Okay. Why?
Living in a cave, sitting on the bottom.
Squids don't do that?
Squids are generally more active mid-column or, you know, open water feeders.
Even freshwater squids?
There's no such thing. So let's talk about the first problem. Wait, with the giant squid theory.
Okay.
Or the squid or octopus. Cephalopods in general.
Is there freshwater octopus?
No.
Hmm.
Yes.
Huh?
Kind of.
Huh?
Maybe.
What?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
So there's some problems with, because I was wondering this when we were doing this, when I was seeing this. Why aren't there any freshwater cephalopods?
Right.
And it's because of their very unique biology. There's some fundamental problems with them moving into freshwater.
Okay.
So are there any freshwater species of octopus? This is kind of a weird subject with much debate in biologists, marine biologists from all over the planet, whether there are any true freshwater octopus or brackish, you know, can the brackish species survive freshwater for a little bit?
Right.
Or, you know, are they exclusive saltwater creatures? Right now there's studies coming out that suggest they may be able to survive freshwater environments. So there's maybe a couple species, and I'll talk about the actual family order, that has some biological capabilities to actually move into freshwater. We think right now for just foraging, but that may have led an ancestor a long time ago to moving into freshwater environments.
Okay.
Because they can go on land, right? So octopus, fascinating creatures. They belong to the cephalopod family. Squids, cuttlefish, and nautilus are as well. Do you know what a nautilus is?
I know. Like, I can picture them in my head. I know what it looks like.
The big red and white shells with all the, like, 100 tentacles, like 50, 60 tentacles coming out of it.
It's basically looks like that Pokemon.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of it, but you know what I'm talking about.
It is that Pokemon, just turned upside down.
Gotcha. Okay.
There's also paper nautilus, which are not nautilus. They are octopus.
Huh. Never heard of that one.
So it's really unique because they kind of evolve the same way. They make a shell, these paper nautilus do, but they hold on to their shell, and they excrete the chemicals to make it.
Huh.
The nautilus is a part of its body. Like it's fused together.
Okay.
Like a snail.
Okay.
The paper nautilus, you can pull it out of its shell or it can leave its shell.
Because it's made.
But it's making it. It's not finding a shell and using a shell.
Right.
It is actively making its own shell. It's very unique.
Mm. Sounds interesting.
That'll be freaky fun one day.
Ooh.
So octopus, you know, dominated every saltwater environment on the planet. From the Arctic Sea to the tropics. From shallow coral reefs to the deep sea abyss to tide pools even. There's several species that hunt on land.
They're very intelligent. They're apex creatures, for sure.
8 arms, 3 hearts, unique physiology. One of the most intelligent and adaptable marine creatures. They feed on pretty much everything. There are no herbivorous octopi. Octopi is the plural.
Okay.
They do have chromatophores, which is the ability that specialized pigment cells that extend and contract to produce different colors. So they actually don't change color. They have one color that they stretch and change for us to perceive as different colors.
Which is wild to think about, because I always thought they were changing color.
Yeah. No, they're just stretching. So they're stretching like one little color cell.
Yeah. Open. Yeah.
And they also have texturable skin.
Right.
They have little muscles in their skin to change the texture.
Which is crazy. They can blend into anything.
They're extremely sensitive to vision, touch, and smell. Octopus use their arms to touch and taste their surroundings. There's even some evidence to suggest some cephalopods have a primitive eye-like organ on the end of their tentacles.
Like cameras on the end of their...
Essentially.
Basically.
Because each individual arm has a brain at the base. And then goes all to the central brain. So they may be able to stick their tentacles. And we don't know if it's like a full eye or, you know, what we don't know or what just it's kind perceiving.
Of sensing organ.
Yeah. It's like, something. There's something there where it can stick its tentacle into a hole. It's getting touch and feel, but it's also getting vision out of that.
Hmm. Wonder if it's like a shark's nose.
When the electromagnetic sensors?
Yeah. It's something like that. Because I bet that would work too. You stick sure. it in a hole. And
oh, you would know if anything's alive in there.
Right, yeah.
So octopus are fascinating creatures, known for their intelligence and unique abilities. They can also survive in any of the ocean environments. But there's some evidence now, and this is highly debated in marine biology right now.
Oh, okay.
There seems to be some species that can survive in freshwater environments. However, it's important to note that freshwater octopus are not commonly found in the world ever. So freshwater octopus belong to the genus Amphrotopus, which includes several species found in brackish water and estuaries. So these are specialists in those environments.
Okay.
So, like I said, there seems to be some adaptations. There's also one species and one cousin that lives on hydrothermal vents that is freshwater or has freshwater coming out of it. So it seems like they're learning, or they're adapting the ability to make trips into freshwater to forage and have to come back to saltwater.
Okay.
So they're not fully freshwater, but they're able to survive longer than their kin.
Do they have gills like fish?
Kinda. It's not like fish. It's an internal sac.
Do they? So they breathe.
It's halfway between a lung and a gill. It's really hard to explain without showing you pictures.
Interesting.
But they can hold water inside.
I guess I'm just wondering what's the difference between fresh and salt water for them?
Oh, salinity is huge because remember osmosis.
Ah.
So that makes the fish and animals that do that have special adaptations.
Yeah.
But also octopus have copper-based blood, which we'll talk about.
Okay.
And that makes it very hard to transfer oxygen.
The copper-based?
Hold on to it. It makes it very hard to transfer oxygen from freshwater environments.
Okay, makes sense.
They just suffocate. So yeah, these octopus families have been observed in rivers and even streams in a couple cases.
Okay.
Normally within, like I said, miles of theirs.
Copper-based blood?
Hold on to it for a second. So while freshwater octopus are interesting creatures, they are not commonly kept in pets due to their difficulty maintaining specific environments. Basically, they need to be able to move back and forth between salt and freshwater.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of their physiology, these freshwater octopus have the hearts that are adapted to pumping blood in lower salinity levels, which that's the next thing we'll talk about. Mm. They have specialized skin cells that help them maintain osmosic balance in freshwater too.
Okay.
So they're starting to be able to lock down. Not permanently. Like I said, it's just short trips.
Yeah.
So basically we have transitional species of these guys.
Okay.
We have a couple species, quote unquote, working on it to go into freshwater environments longer and longer.
Interesting. Okay.
Because it's the same reason why bull sharks pup in estuaries and in freshwater. Because those freshwater environments have no, like that, a baby bull shark is just cannon fodder in the ocean.
Right, yeah.
And in the Mississippi River, there's like three fish that can touch it.
Right, yeah.
So your kids or you have more success.
Much better chance.
Yeah. So these guys are finding more opportunities in freshwater environments.
You know, if the octopus would have just landed in freshwater and not in the ocean when they first arrived on this planet, they'd be fine.
So yes, let's talk about
copper blood.
Yeah. So why is it so hard for octopus? And you know, when fish do it, right? Fish, you know, go, they're called androgynous, where they go from fresh and salt and back and forth. Yeah. Marine mammals, some can do it, most can't. And that's due to some other reasons. So why can't cephalopods do it? Why is it such a hard stop? Cephalopods have a lot of hearts, three hearts to be exact. Two biennial hearts push oxygen depleted blood through the gills, and their somatic heart pumps the oxygenated blood through the body. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they have a three heart system. For cephalopods, the term blue blood is taken literally, not really meaning the medieval sense of nobility. Their blood is actually blue.
Literally blue.
While humans and other animals rely on iron-based oxygen transport systems, cephalopods have copper-based transport systems.
So what's that mean? Well, okay, for us, iron-based, what's that mean?
So red blood cells?
Yeah.
It's an iron molecule.
Okay.
That's what we're using as a building block to transport oxygen through the body.
And iron's like the main catalyst of that cell.
Yes.
So like a, is it like a
snowflake? The chemical reaction, essentially, that's holding oxygen and releasing oxygen is iron.
Oh, okay, okay.
For these guys, it's copper.
Gotcha. Okay.
So the red blood cells are actually copper, not iron.
Gotcha.
That's why they're blue. They're not red blood cells, but they're, you know, they're blood.
Okay. Is that why iron, when it rusts, you know, it has that orangey?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
So, source of blue. The copper-based molecule in cephalopod's blood is called hemosilin, which binds the oxygen and carries it through the body and powers the muscles. Mm. But it's significantly lower oxygen binding power when compared to iron-based hemoglobin.
Okay.
So it just does not cut it.
It's not as good.
Yeah, not as good. So they get around this, you know, saltwater environments. Okay, I'll finish. So hemoglobin, those studies of the Antarctic octopus, Paralaodontis cethuri, suggest that the hemosyn systems help cephalopods maintain efficient oxygen transport in environments in varying temperatures and oxygen levels. Hemosyn is the most efficient in cold water, but loses its hold on oxygen with more acidic water, suggesting that the ocean's becoming warmer and more acidic due to climate change. Cephalopods may struggle in these climate areas. So basically, the hemosyn they have is better at a wider range of environments.
Okay.
But it's not great in a lot of them. It's more to get you through.
Okay.
So if you want to go on land for short trips,
it'll work.
Yeah. So why fish can breathe air, they can actually pull oxygen out of the air. It just, their gills, which would be like our lung tissue, they dry out. So they lose their permeability.
Okay.
So that's why they stop.
Gotcha.
So yeah, the big thing is these guys kind of run out of copper.
All right. I understand what you're saying.
Do you? You get it?
You see where you're hinting at.
So as I was looking into this, it seems, so there's plenty of animals in nature, like elephants and salt, for example, that will go into deep caves to eat salt to maintain body chemistry in areas they normally could not live.
Are you telling me in Lake Superior, there's an octopus?
Several, yes.
That figured out that there's copper here and they're using it to maintain, I don't know, what did we learn, homeostasis?
Yeah, sure.
It's like out of a sci-fi book.
All of the stuff we talk about is out of a sci-fi. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, yeah, but this one's literally like...
And he didn't... Now, let me finish.
Yeah.
Because he didn't venture into the Great Lakes.
What do you mean?
So, you ever heard of the Devil's Hole pubfish? Yes, you have. We've talked about it many times.
Okay.
Basically, it's these little tiny fish. There's only like 110 of them. They're the most endangered vertebrate on the planet.
Now I remember, yes.
They live in a hole in the desert, and everybody's like, how'd they get there? They were part of the giant ocean, and when it drying up, this they got all, stuck there.
Yeah, that's all that's left.
So some parts of the Great Lake, like the giant salt deposit under Lake Erie, is a remnant.
Which is being mined.
Yeah, a remnant of that prehistoric ocean.
Okay.
So my thought, so in the Jurassic Sea, the giant ocean that used to be in the middle of the U.S., I don't actually remember the Jurassic Sea, but there is giant cephalopod, not fossils, but fossil evidence.
Okay.
So octopus keep treasures, and they make art. So they found a 120-foot-wide art bone sculpture of an octopus, including massive pieces of dinosaur bone in the sea that used to be in the middle of the States.
Well, I mean, is that evidence of man being creative?
No, I think it's definitely the... Because it matches some of our modern species.
Okay.
Just modern species are a lot smaller.
Right.
So they're just like, this is a big cousin.
Okay.
Because it's the same art. It's like when the puffer fish make their big circles.
Okay, gotcha.
It's just like a sexual display thing. Like, yeah. Look, I can make this.
Interesting.
But some of the bones were like bigger than people.
Yeah. So it had to be a big creature that made it.
So my thought is, what if these creatures were a part of this massive ocean, the inland sea? As it started drying up, they slowly adapted to less and less salinic environments.
I mean,
so they started adapting to less and less salinity.
Yeah.
When they got down to the brass tacks of only being in a few of the Great Lakes, they had a little bit, they had to do a little extra.
They needed something to help transfer the oxygen around their body.
Yeah. So what if the mining of all of these underground, underwater tunnels, these copper nodes, this thing living in a copper cave? Is them actually eating the material as a part to get more copper in? I'm not talking like eating big chunks of it. You know, they're eating little pieces or just even being maybe around it from it, you know, dissipating in the water.
Yeah, yeah.
The higher copper contents.
Yeah.
What if there's just a couple of them left, or, you know, a small population of these guys left?
And this is their last stronghold because there's that big copper deposit.
So all these holes are like, look, it was mined by stone, but we don't know where this copper went. That was thousands and thousands of years of giant octopus eating it.
It's getting dissolved into their blood. There's
all these stone hatchets that they say were eating at these tunnels.
Was octopus beak.
It was beaks.
Beaks. That makes the most sense, actually.
Now, I have one more thing for you. And this may all be crazy. This is what I was really excited for.
So, oh, you're just now getting to the crazy part?
You know, this all is crazy. I don't know. I don't know if there really is giant octopus living in Lake Superior, but if they are, this is the best bet.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about bioluminescence in octopus specifically.
Okay.
You know what? It's almost always one color.
Let me guess, green.
And you want to guess what color it is?
Green.
It's almost always green when it's octopus, not squids.
Because squids like red and white.
They have all kinds. Yeah. Octopus can do it other colors, but...
They like black and white, like literally not black or white, black and white together. Yeah. They can do it all.
But the bioluminescent bacteria that they have in their skin is almost always green. And they farm basically this bioluminescent skin.
Do you think like maybe if you were to... Take one of them and you just, I don't know, stab it in the eye. It would excite all the...
Yeah, I think it would freak out.
Yeah. And that might excite the bioluminescent bacteria in its skin.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. They also do have photophores, which do emit the green-blue light spectrum.
Okay.
So they have a glow to them. They use it to attract prey, confuse potential predators, and even talk to each other in the ocean.
Hmm.
So what if this thing was trying to talk to the guy first? Because think about it, a giant cephalopod, it crushed him in a second.
Right, yeah.
If it wanted to.
So this is probably what happened. He's in the cave, and it swoops down, and it just pops, you know, blocks the entrance off, and it just says to him, what you doing in my waters? And he's like...
Old Greg?
Yeah, he freaks out and stabs it.
And it's just freaking out, slamming around.
Yeah.
Now, because, you know, the octopus wrestling, we talked about in the giant octopus of Puget Sound and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The octopus are... The giants there, the monstrous ones, never do anything to anybody. They're playful. People are the ones harassing them.
Right.
That's the only time any dangers happen is when people go down and go into their holes and grab them.
And steal their copper.
But, like, those are ocean ones. They don't need the copper.
Oh, yeah, those ones are. The Puget Sound. I'm talking about this one.
Yeah. But that's may have been why he's like lives in a copper node.
Right.
Not that he's even protecting copper. It just happens to be where he can breathe the easiest.
Yeah, I was going
to
say that. Yeah, that would make most sense.
You know, get these elements that are rarer in his environment. So I kind of really think that maybe there's a chance that this is a remnant species of the great ocean.
Mm.
And kind of, as the ocean was drying up and it blooded into where the glaciers ended and all this stuff, you know, to form the Great Lakes, it just kind of made the right ground for maybe a small handful of these guys living.
I mean, octopus are intelligent. They'll find a way to live.
And they're extremely shy.
Ooh. Okay.
They are.
Another piece of the puzzle.
Some of the biggest octopus fit like cities like Octopolis and, you know, the giant 40, 50 million, you know, octopus that live in a town they built.
Mm.
You know, we didn't discover until relatively recently. And one had to grab a guy by the hand and lead him there.
See, I don't even know about this.
Octopolis?
Yeah.
There's Octo Atlantis too. There's just like giant villages of octopus in the ocean.
That's an episode.
Yeah.
I need to know more, learn more about this.
But no, it's just weird to me. So if this is, let's say this is just yellow journalism, right? They just made it up and it was just one of those things. Because that happened a lot in the 18s and the 19s.
Well, in the Weekly World News?
Yeah, all that. Well, you seem to know.
I think those are truthful.
Men in Black told you they were.
I think they are truthful.
So let's just say maybe it is yellow journalism, right?
Okay.
So why, and that's kind of where I was leaning with it because this is it. This is the one account I could find of it. There are other sightings of tentacled creatures in Lake Superior. But, you know, it's more like the Oklahoma octopus thing.
Right, yeah.
But the copper and the connection with cephalopods and copper was astonishing to me.
Yeah, it is.
The light and the way it was flashing light was astonishing to me.
Hmm. I mean, there's a lot of overlap.
There was enough of it when I was starting to do this that I was like, there's just enough there to have to talk about it.
It could be something.
And this could all be fake. This could be a guy just was like writing it up.
And if it is, let's say it is fake, it's someone that has a lot of knowledge then when it comes to...
Nobody in 1886 knew that octopus had copper-based blood.
I don't know. There's got to be one guy.
Not some pilot from the UP of Michigan.
That would be the kind of guy that would know that thing.
No, maybe the Lady of the Dunes, Diana of the Dunes.
That she would know.
But that was later in the 19s.
Oh, yeah, true. She still would know.
I actually don't know when they discovered like copper blood versus that kind of stuff.
Yeah, when that discovery was made.
And if any octopus was going to survive, I did leave this out. If any octopus was going to survive in fresh water, it would be colder fresh water, which Lake Superior is frigid.
Mm.
Holds more oxygen. Mm. Like, would not be in the warmer bodies of water. I don't know. Maybe it... I really think that... I really don't know how I feel about the cave monster of Lake Superior.
Yeah.
Whether it's real or not. But there's just so many of these little hints.
That it could be.
That there's enough there. I kind of wonder if there's a giant... If the giant... These 5,000 mines in Lake Superior, in the water, that have been mined as deep as 20 feet... Like, into the cave.
That'd make more sense than...
They're just thousands of years at giant cephalopods just chewing at them.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Just chewing on it. That's enough. Maybe that's all they need, too, to keep their body regulated to survive.
There's plenty of animals that do that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's, like, ibexes. Those are the ones that walk on almost 90-degree surfaces to get the salt licks.
Oh, gotcha. The goats.
Yeah, they're goats.
Yeah.
They're not really goats. They're cousins of goats.
Close enough.
Or the elephants that go deep into caves.
Yeah.
So these animals end up in extremely weird places to get the minerals they need.
Mm.
It's not unheard of. We just, as, you know, iron-based, you know, blood, we just don't ever think of copper as a mineral that we need.
Right.
But we eat a lot of iron.
Right.
Whether it's in cereal or foods or, you know, plants, whatever, we take in.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of iron.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's our circulatory system's base.
Right, we need it.
So why wouldn't these guys do the same thing?
If
there were some, they would get stuck here.
Right, exactly, yeah. And over time, you know where that ancient sea was? I mean, it makes enough sense that if it did make it from then to now, they would have adapted enough to live.
All right, I have been the great and powerful mystery.
And I've been J-Clone 8.
We'll catch you next week, guys.
Bye. Bye.
Hey, guys. Thank you for listening to Cryptids of the Corn Podcast. Remember, the best way to support the show is share it with a friend. But if you are craving more of the J-Clones
and more from Mr. E,
there's always extra content on Patreon
and our paid member space on CryptidsOfTheCorn.com.
We'll catch you next time with more exciting, fun, and informative information.
Bye! Bye.